Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Jason Smith from Fort Worth. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. It's exciting to be here with, you know, real appellate lawyers.
Well, that's debatable, I guess. Depends on how you define appellate lawyer. And, you know, we appellate lawyers do a lot of different things. And I know that your practice, even though you do a whole lot of stuff in the trial court, appellate work is part of your practice. And so we're happy to visit with you today about all aspects of that and more. So, Jason, just to kind of give our listeners a sense of who you are, if they don't know you, tell us about your background, sort of where you come from, what got you sort of where you are today.
Sure. My dad was a pilot in World War II. And after the war, he moved to Fort Worth, Texas. And with my mom, they started a family. He was a pilot. My big brother was the first local to be in the Van Cliburn piano competition. He's a classical pianist. He's just super talented. I went away for college to San Antonio, to St. Mary's, and then to law school out at Tech. And then after clerking in Austin, moved back to Fort Worth and just have my own practice trying to help people.
So one of the things that we talked before we started recording was your experience. You said you went to undergrad at St. Mary's, which that was my law school. Way more people that went to law school there than undergrad, but I've known some. But you specifically talk about your experience at Texas Tech Law School and how that helped to kind of shape you and was a good experience for you. Will you expound on that a little bit for us?
Sure. St. Mary's is a great school for pre-law and pre-med students, but I didn't have the money to make the law school work. And when I went to Texas Tech, it was, I think, $90 a semester hour. It was $1,500 a semester with fees. And it was a great place to go to law school because there wasn't much else to do and distract you. So, and Dean Frank Newton really put Texas Tech on the map by really holding students accountable. At one point, he was putting a third of the student body on scholastic probation, not because they really belonged to be there, and because they wanted to scare folks into passing the bar. And that's what they did. My year, 97% of our class passed the bar. Only two people flunked it. We were a machine. And I think Texas Tech is kind of a small pond. And it was, in that respect, it was great for me because I got an opportunity to work at the Texas Supreme Court along with, you know, a lot of the big brain people who come from University of Texas and Harvard and Yale and Georgetown, and really just a great opportunity.
I wouldn't think of Tech as a small pond, but maybe it was in the 90s.
You know, I think it's a small pond in terms of there's not a lot of focus there. And so, but certainly now Tech with its sports dominance and baseball and basketball and not really football yet, once in future football dominance, it certainly is put itself on the map. But Texas Tech, in terms of law school, great place, kind of a hidden gem and a small pond where you can really develop some skills.
Did you know coming out of law school that you had an interest in appellate law, or did you just think, you know, Texas Supreme Court seems like a great place to go and learn something?
I wanted to be a bankruptcy lawyer. And I thank God every day I got the clerkship at the Texas Supreme Court because my plan was to interview at the Texas Supreme Court as practice for the real the World Series of clerkships to clerk for a bankruptcy judge in the interview with the bankruptcy. And Dean Newton called me after I interviewed and said, Jason, you don't understand. If a Texas Supreme Court justice offers you a job, you say, yes, sir, I'll see you in August. And I hung up the phone with Dean Newton, and I picked up the phone, and it was Jack Hightower offering me a job at the Texas Supreme Court. And there disappeared my dreams of being a bankruptcy law clerk.
Sometimes the path chooses you, and you don't choose the path, right?
Thank God.
How was your time clerking with Justice Hightower? I mean, it was certainly a different court than I think we have today, maybe some different personalities.
Well, I think the Texas Supreme Court had just come out of the 80s and the 60 Minutes expose on justice for sale. And Justice Hightower was part of a group of judges elected in 1988 that really restored confidence in the court and really gave balance to the court. Justice Hightower was a moderate. He was usually the swing vote, he and Justice Gonzalez. And from that vantage point, it was fascinating to watch the far ends of the court really hold each other accountable. The best opinions I saw written were opinions that never made the light of day, because Justice Hecht would write an opinion and then Justice Doggett would write a dissent that would point out flaws. And so Justice Hecht would tighten up his opinion based on that draft. And it really made for coherent, consistent law when you had those two ends holding each other accountable.
Well, I remember some opinions from that time where things were a little almost out of bounds in terms of what we usually see in judicial opinions from the Supreme Court these days. It's fair to say, I think, that those two really challenged each other in many ways. But I wish I could have seen some of those drafts and how, you know, what the starting point was versus the end point, and have that insider information. That's one of the best things about clerking at the court, is being able to watch that process unfold.
It is, and it was real. The opinions were certainly a little more personal than Justice Hightower was comfortable with. He was more focused on policy, being a former member of Congress and a former member of the Texas Senate. But the substance of those opinions really holds up in terms of a coherent jurisprudence, both from Justice Hecht and Justice Doggett. I really think they kept each other honest. And we had better, more balanced decisions because we had some moderate justices, and we had justices at either end. I think it really served Texas jurisprudence.
Well, and you kind of alluded to it, and that was one of my questions. You were there at an interesting time when the court had just sort of transitioned out of the 60 Minutes period that was so infamous. So it seems like there probably was a big emphasis on accountability and, you know, honesty and opinions to make sure that it all got out the right way.
Well, sometimes it wasn't personally comfortable, because some people did have a style that was a little more acidic and a little more, some would take as personal. And, you know, that you can debate that. I think maybe it could be done without that. But the result really, I think, shows that case law stands up. You know, the other thing about clerking at the Texas Supreme Court from a place like Texas Tech, there was another law clerk from, there were a couple from Baylor, and there's one from University of Houston. And then we had the Yale and all the University of Texas people and the Georgetown law clerk. And it really showed that law is pretty universal, and we didn't really feel out of our element. We did have like a dictionary for UT Yale words and Texas Tech University of Houston words. I think the UT Yale word was paradigm, and the translation for University of Houston, Texas Tech was thing. So we had a dictionary that so we could understand one another, but it was, again, that diversity was really interesting, and you learn a lot being from the small pond of Texas Tech, seeing really, really bright people work for the court.
After your clerkship, kind of how did your practice develop into what it is now?
I went and worked for a downtown law firm in Fort Worth that represented the school district, represented General Dynamics, which turned into Lockheed, doing employment work. And then I did some personal injury work for the other half of the firm. And it really gave me a great opportunity. And I actually founded the Tarrant County Appellate Section with then Ann Gardner, later Justice Gardner, who was, I think, the president of the Tarrant County Bar and was really behind it. And it just kind of took off from there. And I went back and worked for the Texas Supreme Court as a staff attorney until Justice Hightower retired. And then I worked for the Attorney General. And Austin's a hard place to be a grown up. So I had to move back to Fort Worth. And I worked for Art Brender, who really was an amazing lawyer, was the only lawyer to win a civil rights case at the United States Supreme Court in the 1980s in the Rehnquist Court, a case called Clara Watson versus Fort Worth Bank and Trust. And Art Brender really showed that good lawyering at an appellate level, even with conservative courts, if you present it the right way, conservative courts are going to issue opinions, not just stuck with ideology, but with the law.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge. Well, that's where I first came in contact with you, is when you were on your second rotation with Justice Hightower. And I remember you from those days, and even though you had to be a really young lawyer at that time, I mean, I recall that I know you had Justice Hightower's respect, and he relied on you a lot, as the justices tend to do with their staff attorneys. And being in a position to come back as a staff attorney as a relatively young lawyer must have been a privilege.
Right. And again, working at the Texas Supreme Court really informs your ability to practice as a trial lawyer, because you're looking back at a trial and you're looking at the mistakes and you're looking at what has to be done to preserve the record. And it just more fully informed that, because I'd actually been in a courtroom and I'd actually tried a case. And then I came back and then it all kind of clicked even more. It's kind of amazing. And I think clerkships are great. And I'm glad the Texas Supreme Court still has clerkships that are year long for lawyers. And then those lawyers go out in the world. I think that really helps the bar. I wish there were a little bit more diversity of practice that those folks went out to. But I think it's great. And I wish more courts would keep that, because I think that's good for the bar to have people who are inside those courts coming out and giving insight as to how they do it. But boy, as a first year lawyer, you know, there's a lot you don't know. And, you know, when you get out in that second year after working at the court, you're kind of like, what do you mean I don't get to write the judge's opinion?
Or a partner wants to come in and edit all your work. You know, hey, my writing was good enough at the Texas Supreme Court. What do you mean?
That's right.
You were at the AG's office for a while. Then you went back to Fort Worth and went in with Art. That was when you went in with Art Brender, right? But you've had your own practice for quite some time now. So tell us about what you do kind of on a daily basis at your law firm.
Well, in 2014, Art really throttled back and I started my own practice representing people, employment cases and personal injury cases. And I would win cases and then the defendants wouldn't want to resolve the cases or pay the judgment and they'd appeal it. So I got a lot of appellate experience that way. And then the other thing is I have a lot of what people would kind of popularly call civil rights cases with kind of that bent to them. And when you sue governmental entities, there's a lot of interlocutory appeals. And so I've really gained also a lot of appellate experience through those interlocutory appeals that drag out those cases pending at the trial court. And then I really had a great experience in Campbell versus Wilder, which was a case that involved the charging of court costs to indigent folks. And I got to work with Chief Justice Jefferson, who had retired and had agreed to represent some folks who were being forced to pay court costs by the district clerk, that even though they'd been declared indigent. And really watching Chief Justice Jefferson and his colleague, Amy Warr, such high-level, talented appellate lawyers, it just really gave me a whole nother idea about how appellate law can be used to advance your state court and your federal court trial practice.
Your orientation really is you're representing mostly individuals, I think, in labor and employment cases and some PI cases, even today, right?
There was a represented a lesbian teacher was reprimanded after she showed a picture of her fiance to her class, just argued a case for some Fort Worth police officers that reported violations of law by another police officer who was abusive towards an African-American family. I had an age discrimination case that went to the Fort Worth Court of Appeals and the Texas Supreme Court. I've had an arbitration case. So I've had a lot of employment, personal injury cases, mainly employment on the appellate front, honestly. There's something about employment law that just seems to be more attuned to the parties appealing it rather than personal injury cases.
And that's a topic we really haven't talked about that much since we started this podcast. So it's interesting to hear about.
Well, I think that, you know, in the Title VII and the discrimination statutes really were litigated for the longest time in federal court. And there was a whole body of law. And in fact, there wasn't even a right to a jury trial until the 1990s in those cases. And so I think that employment lawyers just got much more comfortable using appeals to kind of ferret out the claims.
You know, you, I think maybe by virtue of that practice a little bit, but you have a lot of cases that end up, I think, in the news. How do you handle that as an attorney representing clients, kind of the media side of things? Because that's not something we've talked about much.
That's interesting. I talk to every client about, you know, sometimes a case will just get into the news, I'll file it and a reporter will call. Other times I'll share a copy of the petition. But what I start with is I start with a client. And especially when you're suing a governmental entity or a big institution like a university or the city of Fort Worth, there just is going to be some scrutiny and some from the public on that sort of situation. But I start with my client and I go, look, you need to decide if you're comfortable being in the news, because a lot of people aren't. And I've had a lot more clients say, I don't want this in the press if we can avoid it. Now, sometimes you can't avoid it. Sometimes the reporter calls. And I think it's important for the public to understand our justice system and what's going on to give a fair account, not a, you know, we really try to stick to what we could prove in court or what the law is. But I think it's important for people to understand that our justice system works and it can work for them, because I think people have some misconceived notions about how the justice system's distorted. Part of that's by insurance companies putting out things, kind of fibbing on what personal injury lawsuits really are. But some of it is you've got people who are just distrustful of the system. And I think people out in the public need to understand the system and understand what how good our system really is.
So given your emphasis on employment law, I would imagine that and you mentioned state court cases and the trend toward some of those cases being brought in state court. I bet you're in federal court an awful lot as well, in addition to state.
I've ended up doing more. Sometimes you can't avoid federal court because of diversity and the defendants will remove it to federal court. Judge Denny Chin, who was considered by President Obama to be nominated to the Supreme Court, wrote an article about employment summary judgment in federal court, and 76% of all employment cases are dismissed on summary judgment in federal court. That's a much higher rate than state court. Now, that I think that article came out in 2012, 2013. I think that trend has gone down a little bit because there has been some writings by the U.S. Supreme Court that has kind of discouraged that, even with this conservative court. But you see that. And I had a disability discrimination case for a veteran, a guy who did 4 tours of duty in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he had a disability, he had PTSD. And his boss didn't like the effect that the medicine had on him and would just say these awful things about his PTSD and then fired him for kind of bogus reasons. And the Fifth Circuit was very open to that appeal after it had been dismissed by Judge Fitzwater, who's a great judge in the Northern District of Texas. But Fifth Circuit, even though they're considered a conservative circuit, they've even been just more open about the disposition of these cases. And I think it's how you frame them. I don't think you can frame them in kind of a 1960s, 1970s civil rights narrative anymore. I think they kind of have to be framed in a more practical modern economy way that, you know, this is really a way that workers in our global economy can protect themselves from being subjected to, you know, the denial of opportunity.
As Jody pointed out, it seems like a number of your cases wind up being covered in the media. And I actually, it's fun to see that media coverage even all the way down here in Austin. But you made mention to me that, you know, you've kind of been you might consider a trailblazer in some ways. I think you mentioned that you won the first sexual harassment jury verdict in Tarrant County way back in 1999. I guess it's just kind of taken off since then.
In that case, it's interesting. I represented a woman named Donna Davis who worked for the Union Pacific Railroad. She was sexually harassed in the workplace. Her granddad had worked for the railroad. And so she was a real railroader. She worked on the maintenance and way, kind of keeping the track safe for trains. And she was harassed. And then she complained about it. And her boss fired her. And Tarrant County, there are a lot of really hardworking people in Tarrant County. Tarrant County really is kind of it doesn't have a bunch of corporations. It has a bunch of workers. And Tarrant County jurors aren't that generous on or understanding in personal injury cases, I think, is their reputation. Not everyone in Tarrant County has a sore back, but everyone has a job. And if they see that someone is kind of rooked out of their job, they'll do something about it. And in that case, I think what upset the jury more was how she was treated after she tried to get something done about the sexual harassment. But really, I think sexual harassment and Me Too, I think they really show that, you know, women haven't been fully in the workplace with the respect they deserve in the workplace to contribute. And so we still see those types of cases in Tarrant County, unfortunately. I also think that the age discrimination lawsuits are also with companies when they kind of try to reset and bring in young blood. I think age discrimination cases are alive and well. And then race discrimination cases are sadly alive and well. And there's really been an uptick of race discrimination in the workplace in the last 6 years. It's kind of was kind of kept under a hat, I think, for a little while. And now the folks with those racist attitudes have kind of shown themselves again. And that's something we're really going to have to deal with as a society. And one way to deal with it is these anti-discrimination laws.
You know, one thing that we don't often think about from the appellate side is all the administrative buildup that you've got to go through to get a case even just into court in the first place when you're talking about a labor and employment case. I guess you've become an expert in how to do that under both the federal and the state acts.
As I tell my clients, employment discrimination lawsuits are the only lawsuits that you have to file a complaint with a governmental agency before you can go to court. And if you want to sue in state court, you have to wait 180 days before you can get the right to sue and go into court. And that hurry up and wait, sometimes the clients forget. I'll tell them that. They'll call me after about 3 or 4 months and go, hey, why aren't we doing anything? And well, we got to wait until this 180 days. I think the idea of the EEOC and the Texas Workforce Commission Civil Rights Division was well-intentioned. But I don't think they're appropriately funded to really be able to investigate all of these complaints. I do think the complaint process gives people kind of a pressure valve to feel like they at least were heard, but they do hold up folks from being able to bring a case immediately in court. And, you know, sometimes when evidence gets stale, when a case gets older, you know, a jury can get less interested or feel there's less urgency to have to do something about it. But you do have to jump through those hoops. And if you don't, these employers will really hold you to account. So you really need to cross your T's and dot your I's and filing those complaints and giving the agency an opportunity to investigate if they're really going to investigate. But like I say, they really don't have the resources to do that. And that might be a requirement that really needs to be re-examined, at least as a mandatory requirement, maybe as an optional requirement.
Well, and that's, you know, you bring up something that I think raises a good point for people that if you don't do employment law, then don't pick it up as a hobby, because there's a lot of mines and traps along the way that you can really mess up if you don't know what you're doing.
And the courts have really been very particular about making sure all of the requirements are met, especially when you sue a governmental entity. For instance, there was a case out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals where someone got it was an age discrimination case, and they got over $1 million verdict. And they filed suit on the 179th day, said, you have to wait 180 days to sue. And because they didn't wait 180 days to sue, there was no jurisdiction, and they reversed the verdict. That will keep you up at night, making sure that not only you file your complaint in time, but then you also wait long enough so there's not some claim that you have jumped the gun.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. It's kind of like the opposite of limitations.
Yeah, it's a real gotcha, honestly. And then you mentioned governmental entities too. I think about sovereign immunity. How do you have to deal with sovereign immunity when you're in an employment case?
Well, the Texas courts have basically said that they treat any motion for summary judgment on the merits of the case as a challenge to a sovereign immunity challenge. And so those are subject to interlocutory appeal. If I sue a governmental entity, when I'm planning out the case, I plan it out that I'm going to have an appeal in the middle of the case that's probably going to eat up a year to 2 years. And then I have a case right now, another gay rights case where I represent a lesbian against a community college here in Tarrant County. And they challenged her ability to sue to begin with. And then they appealed that, the governmental entity appealed that. The Dallas Court of Appeals, it's interesting. I worked with the Human Rights Campaign, which is kind of the NAACP, like the NAACP, but for gay rights. And they filed an amicus at the Dallas Court of Appeals saying that gays and lesbians should be protected under the state labor code. And the Dallas Court of Appeals held that. And then we've remanded it and we've done our discovery. And now they're filing for summary judgment. And they've been upfront. They're not hiding the ball. They're going to appeal that ruling if it's denied to the Dallas Court of Appeals. So my client will have gone through two appeals before ever having the opportunity of trying the case. And it really is, I think, an important thing of representing, walking around paycheck to paycheck people, is being real clear with them about what the expectations are. And part of the expectations is the time it's going to take. And I try to tell them it can take 2 years on average, but there's some cases I've had that have lasted 7 years. And I tell them that so they have some reasonable expectations.
That kind of transitions us into another thing that we wanted to talk about with you, which is, you know, you represent individuals. A lot of your work is on contingency fees. So how do you handle the money side of things? I mean, you know, particularly trial and appellate fees when you've got these cases that go on for 2, 3, sometimes 7 years on contingency? I mean, how does that work?
Most walking around people can't afford a lawyer, and contingent fees really provide middle class and working class families an opportunity to be a part of our court system. And I really kind of resigned myself to, I'm not going to be fully compensated in every case for the time I spend on the case. The good thing of having done employment law for 20 years, 25 years, is now I've got a bank of briefs, and I've got in my mind kind of a general template of the legal requirements and challenges of a case and the types of evidence I'm looking for. And really, it's that skill going all the way back to the Texas Supreme Court of really doing that no evidence analysis in so many cases and realizing that what I have to do. So thanks again, Justice Hightower. But I think I do build in on the employment cases and the personal injury cases, I build in an escalator where my contingent fee goes up if the case is appealed. My normal contingent fee for an employment case is 40%. And then if there's an appeal in it, it goes up another 10%. And then, you know, the courts have said in L. Apple and in the other cases around that they don't look at the contingency fee to determine a reasonable fee. They look at your hourly fee and the amount of time you have to spend and what's necessary, and then the hourly rate. And so you got to keep your time. You got to present your time to the court. And then you've got to estimate your time for the Court of Appeals. And we can talk about how that's different from state court, federal court in a minute, because I think it's really interesting. I just had a recent experience with that. But in state court, you know, you get your verdict, you testify to what your trial court attorney's fees were, and then you testify what your attorney's fees are going to be on an hourly basis every level, at the Court of Appeals level, at the petition for review stage, at the full briefing stage, at the oral argument stage, at the motion for rehearing stage. And you really just have to lay all that out. That I will say, as a contingent fee lawyer, I'm just not in a good habit of keeping all of my time. And so I think these insurance companies and these defendants, I'm a good bargain because I don't charge near as much as I should. It's just a getting out of practice of keeping that time and being used to being a contingency fee lawyer.
Definitely want to get into the details, but you know, one thing that's also, I think, important to mention here is you've got statutory fee shifting going on. And so that's, yes, the other side, not just your client, but the other side is going to see your documentation of your time. And, you know, what's important in employment, labor and employment cases, civil rights cases, is they do have those statutory mechanisms that authorize fee recovery. So yeah, your client is ultimately charged at a percentage of recovery, but what the other side is hopefully from your perspective going to have to pay isn't necessarily lined up with that percentage. And so it adds a bit of a hammer, I would say, to what it is you're doing, because the defendants know they're exposed not only to whatever the award on behalf of the client's going to be, but also to whatever fee award that you're successful at proving up and getting awarded to you.
That's right. And I do think especially a lot of employment law defendants, you know, employers, well, you know, usually how those cases proceed is they think they've got a good defense that will get a summary judgment granted. And then human beings testify on behalf of the company, and their testimony doesn't necessarily afford that defense. And so a summary judgment is overruled, and then they're looking at a trial. And at a trial, not only are they going to pay my client's damages if a jury rules for them and pay their lawyer to defend the case, attorney's fees, but then they're going to have to pay my client's attorney's fees on top of that. And I do think that that's something that's a good mechanism that Title VII and the Texas Workforce Commission Civil Rights Division laws have afforded. That's an incentive, I think, for these employers to come up with a resolution in these cases of discrimination.
Under the state statute, Has it always been a lodestar kind of approach, even there? I know the federal statute is, we've seen, you know, lodestar. One of the benefits to looking at federal case law is you've got, you know, decades of lodestar cases. Now that we've all kind of had to get used to the idea of lodestar fees when you got statutory fee shifting or contractual fee shifting. So, but has it been lodestar under the state act as well all this time, or something else?
And really, the Texas employment statute is 95% mirrors the Title VII. And so the great thing about that is there is this wealth of case law with regard to the burden shifting analysis and to the lodestar attorney fee analysis and to the interpretation of the damage caps. And so that lodestar analysis on those attorney's fees really has been there. And so it's been something that we've been comfortable with. I will say the state court practice, the one way it has been different, and in the federal court practice has kind of mirrored it in the last decade, is the state court practice has been pretty good of, okay, plaintiff, if you win $1 in damages, you're going to get all of your attorney's fees, not just a proportional attorney fee, but all of your attorney's fees because that time was necessary. And that reasonable rate doesn't change just because of the level of your recovery. And likewise, it's interesting to watch the Fifth Circuit has actually kind of doubled back and kind of embraced that approach in the last decade. And that's certainly good for civil rights plaintiffs.
It seems like there's a lot more precision in the federal system on appellate fees in particular, because you can kind of actually use the evidence of what you spent rather than having to just sort of guess before you even go up.
Yeah, that's the great thing about appellate attorney's fees in federal court that I didn't fully recognize until a recent appeal I had, where I had a default judgment in an employment case against a big furniture, nationwide furniture chain. And we won at the Fifth Circuit. And I normally, the trial court, I had put on testimony of my appellate attorney's fees. And the trial court just awarded me trial court attorney's fees and didn't mention my appellate attorney's fees. And I don't think I had fully appreciated it because it had been a long time since I'd been exposed to that law. But after we won the appeal, I was like, well, I wonder if I can get my attorney's fees. And you can file in federal court, you file a motion for attorney's fees with the Fifth Circuit to get an award of your attorney's fees. And that's what we did in that case. And the court ordered, yep, the trial court's going to now set your appellate attorney's fees. And again, if I'd known that, I would have kept a lot better time. But it is, I think, certainly fair to everyone because you're paying for what actual time folks put into the case rather than, you know, a good faith estimate, which is what I've seen lawyers do. And honestly, I will say 90% of the cases I've had have been close to that good faith estimate in state court, but that's a great option in federal court.
Yeah, I think that ties back to in the federal system, they don't have the one final judgment rule. And so you can have the case go up on appeal on the merits and not including any appellate fees, and then later have a separate judgment, which usually doesn't, it's not entered until after the appeal is over, but the district court will sign a separate judgment, which could then separately be appealed, which creates a lot of appellate work in the federal courts having to do with attorney's fee issues.
That happens in employment cases in federal court. If you sue a corporation and an individual, I had a case again where Judge Fitzwater dismissed the individual in that case I had in this court, in another case I had in this court, and made it final and appealable. And so we appealed that issue as to whether or not there was a cause of action against the individual while we continued discovery against the company on other causes of action that remain pending. And so that really is challenges your ability to keep everything straight and then coordinate everything in case the case gets remanded and you got to try the whole shooting match.
One thing that I've observed over the years is that lawyers who practice a lot in federal court sometimes forget that you actually have to prove up your attorney's fees before or at trial in state court and forget to do it. which is a big trap to be mindful of. If you're doing mostly federal employment law and you come into state court, that's something to really be mindful of.
I think in state court, I think you, my assumption is you have to present, if you want money awarded for anything, damages, attorney's fees, you're going to have to present that to a jury unless you get an agreement out of the other side that can be submitted post-judgment. Now, I will say in all of my employment cases in state court, I try to get an agreement that we're going to present any issue of attorney's fees to the judge, because I just don't think on both sides, I don't think juries really want to hear about what lawyers do. I think they want to hear about the client stories and what they're facing.
Well, and it just, there's a lot more familiarity from a judge as to how that works than trying to kind of explain it to the jury. I'll throw out my PSA for anybody listening who hasn't proven up appellate fees in a long time in Texas. There's a recent case from the Texas Supreme Court called Yowell versus Granite Operating, where the court kind of imposes a stricter standard on what you have to do for appellate fees. So if you haven't read it, next time you're going to do an affidavit or testify or whatever, go read it on appellate fees, because you have to be a little more specific now than you used to.
One big takeaway from that case:
you can't just say a reasonable fee for the Court of Appeals is $40,000 anymore. You've got to say my reasonable rate for an appeal is this. Here's the steps and kind of a forecast of what the hours for the particular tasks of the Court of Appeals would be. Same thing for the Texas Supreme Court. So just it's more of a lodestar formula. And it doesn't have to be perfect, because the court says, you know, there's no precision, obviously, because you're estimating, but you have to give more detail than just saying, you know, a fee for an appeal is X. It's got to be closer to what you would do under Rohrmoos for trial fees.
Yeah, I've got a couple of affectionate descriptions of Yowell. And one is the court has to make a Rohrmoos guess, to kind of borrow some federal parlance. And the other, I also kind of like to call it Rohrmoos light, because you are staring, you know, prospectively into the future and being still asked to give your crystal ball prediction. But it's, as Jody's pointed out, it's way more detailed than, yeah, I've been practicing law for 50 years and I think an appeal should cost X. Yeah, I think the courts, the direction that's the jurisprudence is going in on that is, if you testify that way, you're at real risk of getting your judgment reversed and rendered on appellate fees. And I've seen it happen. I've also seen, it's funny how the law develops, but I've also seen some courts really bend over backwards to avoid that outcome. Even they've done it historically on the trial fees, really tried to avoid a rendition of a judgment, awarding zero fees if there's otherwise the judgment supports fees. I think that we're going to start seeing more of the rendition on appellate fees when we don't see the evidence there that the courts, the Supreme Court, especially in Yowell, has said has to be there. So it's sort of a trial lawyer beware when you're testifying about appellate fees. You need to make sure, as Jody said, go and read that opinion to make sure you understand what it means, because it really does impact potential recovery. And then when you're in a contingent fee situation, like your cases are, Jason, you know, it can impact both the client and the lawyer, because I don't know how your agreements are structured, but is it out of one big pot, or do you segregate out the fee recovery and say, you know, whatever the fee recovery is going to be is what's first credited to the attorney's fee portion under the contingent fee agreement?
I think that's interesting. And because I'm an appellate nerd, I stay up at night thinking about these issues. I think that you have to be, with an appellate fee award, or any fee award, you have to be careful. You can't split fees with a client. And so if the client recovers $10,000 and you recover $100,000, well, if it's not a settlement where there's not any allocation, but it's a court order where the damages are $10,000 and the fees are $100,000, I don't think you can split those fees. What I do is I do a lump sum. There are some employment lawyers that I've seen that have a contingency fee, which is, it's 40% or the amount of any attorney fee award, whichever is greater. And I think that's probably safer from the fee splitting situation. I do think you need to be careful that it's not seen as an unconscionable or an illusory contract where the attorney is getting to load up on their recovery and the individual is loading up on their recovery. Because I say this all the time, hey, we're here to compensate people who have had problems and not make lawyers rich. You know, if we get paid for what we do, that's great. As a contingency fee lawyer, there's some cases I'm going to be paid on, and then there's some cases that I'm just going to spend a lot of time on because I think it's a righteous cause and it, not necessarily going to put any of my kids through college.
I think that approach you mentioned is, I've seen it done that way where it's whichever is greater. That probably is the solution. And to the extent there's any griping about what the lawyer gets versus what the client gets, I mean, this is the nature of fee shifting and the risk that the lawyer takes in taking on the case. And it's really, you know, unless you in a settlement maybe threw your client under the bus and said, we're going to allocate $10,000 of this $100,000 to the recovery and the other $90,000 to fees, that's a whole different problem than say a judgment that, you know, awards fees at $10,000 or awards damages at $10,000 and fees at $90,000 and you're entitled under your agreement to take the $90,000. You put the responsibility for decision making on that in the court's hands or potentially in the jury's hands. And it seems like that's an equitable outcome considering the risk that the lawyer has taken. But it's a thorny issue. And you point out some good concerns to be mindful of.
Well, one other thing we wanted to talk to you about while we're on the subject of clients is, what's your thought on bringing your client to oral argument in the Court of Appeals?
I'm a big believer in bringing clients to any major hearing in their case, whether that be a summary judgment hearing or, you know, of course, the trial or an appeal. And I think that it's really important that they see the process working because it may not work out for them on appeal. And I want them to see that the judges are really taking the case seriously, but they're also listening to the other side. I think there's a tendency if you just sit in a conference room with your lawyer, well, you just think, well, why don't we just run down the field and score a touchdown? And then when you take them into the courtroom and they see the oral argument, they see the questioning of both sides, they see that there are a bunch of people trying to tackle you as you try to get that ball downfield. So I think they just, it gives them a much more realistic idea of the process. But I also think it makes them appreciate what the process is trying to do. And that is, I think most clients are like, well, you know, I understand that they're trying to listen to the other side too. And I just think it's better for our system for ordinary people to see how our system really works the right way most of the time.
Well, we're kind of getting to the end of our time together, Jason, but there are a couple of things we wanted to cover with you before we let you go. I just have to ask this because I know that it exists, but do you happen to do any impressions of Texas Supreme Court justices?
Well, you know, at the Texas Supreme Court, when I served there, they would have a First Amendment party where all of the law clerks would do a skit or sing a song, or write a song about a judge. One of Justice Doggett's law clerks wrote a song about working for Justice Doggett. And he had a song, it was to the tune of Margaritaville, but it was, he said, wasting away, I got dissents to write. And that was a great song. And then we did a movie, actually, about all the judges in conference. And for some reason, I was selected to play Justice Hecht. And I had a T-shirt made that said, have you hugged your insurance company today? And, oh, I remember his administrative assistant Suzanne just howled so loud, and he laughed, and he just was such a good sport about it. And then, well, he's kind of Ronald Reagan. He's kind of got a Ronald. You kind of get into Ronald Reagan. But Jason, could you get me some nachos? That's about as good as it is. I was a little looser then because I might have had a drink or two when I did the impression. it isn't there, but I still have the T-shirt. And And he was such a good sport about it. And just a great chief who really has done such a great job in advocating for making sure people have access to justice with our funding of access to justice programs.
That's great.
Well, our tradition as we wrap up is to always ask for a tip or a war story. I don't know if you've given a lot of great stuff. I don't know if you have a war story in mind that you'd like to share or a tip, either one.
You know, one, I'd like to say I named my son after appellate justice, Justice Brennan. It makes me happy every day when I read an opinion from Justice Brennan that I get to think of my son. But I think a war story would be oral argument at the Fifth Circuit on an insurance case. And Judge Parker was on the Fifth Circuit at the time. And there was one case from Minnesota that went my way. And there was another case from somewhere else that went the other way. And I got into my argument about 5 minutes. And Judge Parker said, "Well, counsel, doesn't this Minnesota case help you?" And I go, "Yes, Your Honor, it's the strongest case for me." And he goes, "Well, then start talking about that." And so I guess my tip would be, if there's one case that really helps you, get it out there in the first sentence that you say and argue it. Primacy and repetitions. Art Brender would always say, say it first and say it over and over. And I think that holds true for what Judge Parker was saying in that oral argument. And turns out they ruled for my client and citing that Minnesota Court of Appeals. So I have to remind myself of that. Primacy and repetition seems to pay off.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This was really interesting and great information. We really appreciate it.
It's a lot of fun. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Jason.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.